Welcome to the first 2016 episode of Does Not Compute. This week, we are once again sponsored by Hired. Now, it's been a little while since I've talked to you about Hired. So the bottom line is that they're an incredible way to find a new design or development job. You just go to hired.com/doesnotcompute, sign up, and you'll start receiving up to 5 job offers every week. It's free, it's easy, and they have a ton of awesome jobs from great companies. Salary and equity are listed upfront in offers, which makes it really easy to decide which ones you want to pursue. Hired works with over 2,500 awesome companies from all over, including places like New York City, San Diego, London, Atlanta, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and, of course, San Francisco. I already mentioned that Hired is free for you to use, but what I didn't tell you is that Hired will give you a $2,000 bonus when you land a job, just to say thanks for using them. But if you sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute instead, they'll double that bonus to $4,000. So you pretty much don't have any excuse. Make sure you sign up today at hired.com/doesnotcompute. And you know me, I'm always the guy who doesn't want to use a framework. So this is kind of right up my alley.
You know, the thing I like about this grid, Paul, is that it's just simple.
What's it called?
Simple Grid.
All right. Well, that makes sense then. Truth in advertising.
Yeah. No, so I've been visiting my parents and my sister for the last few days. And for anyone that doesn't know, my parents have both been just jumping into the programming world. So my dad is the one who introduced me to computers when I was a kid. And he's always been interested in this sort of thing, right? And so that's kind of how I got interested in programming. And my mom has actually been doing front-end development for over a year now, and she's taken on a few freelance projects. So on my break, I came back and visited them, and we've been doing a boot camp of sorts. And for practice for her, I have a bunch of PSDs that I've worked on, and I just say, here's a PSD, code it up. And the grid that I'm having her use is just the simple grid, which I'll link in the show notes, but it's pretty dead simple, which is what I like.
But does it handles responsiveness and all that?
Yeah. So instead of kind of the older style grids where you have just kind of like one class, like .grid-6, and then you would handle the responsiveness in CSS, this kind of gives you some more utility classes. So it'd be grid-6, L, grid-8 for maybe large screens if you want to be wider, and then S-grid-12 if on a small screen you want to be full width. So you get more control, or maybe not more control, you just get quicker control over your grid.
That's nice. I think that for grid responsive stuff like that, that's one of my favorite uses of utility class-like things.
Yeah, especially, you know, when you're trying to, I guess in the early stages of mocking up the design, when you're kind of prototyping the layout, it makes it pretty easy to build that really quickly without having to start splitting up your code into chunks and making different files and different CSS files and such. So for her, it was really simple, never really having used a grid really in-depthly before. So I was able to say, yeah, so here is how I would approach this on desktop, and here's how I would approach it for some kind of responsive situations. And I was able to illustrate that in one file as opposed to hopping around, which is, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a simpler explanation for her.
Definitely, yeah. When you're teaching somebody, you want things to be as simple as possible. That sounds like it makes it easy. So I've been using MDL a bit recently, at least the grid part of it. And one thing that's kind of bothered me with it a bit is that it doesn't have push classes. So there's no way to have something only in the right hand 4 columns and nothing in the left 8 or something similar to that. Does Simple Grid have anything like that?
Yeah, for sure. It has, I mean, it's the same thing as a push. It just calls it offset. So you could do grid-4, offset-2, and then you'll have, obviously, you'll have an element that's 4 columns wide and it has a 2-column margin on the left-hand side.
Nice. That sounds really, really flexible and pretty easy to use. I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah, and then the responsive classes apply to that as well. So you could do m-offset-6 and then s-offset-0, for example, to change things up between iPad-ish size screens and phone-size screens.
Very nice. That sounds awesome. So we actually found two nifty articles from Sarah Sweden. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that somewhat correctly. But she has a couple really cool articles, both on SVGs. One of them is sort of a shootout between SVG and GIF. It's one of those things where you kind of know how it's going to play out beforehand, but it's a nice overview nonetheless. It talks about a bunch of different stuff from resizing to the overall quality to the ability to custom animate stuff, and just pretty much covers all the bases on what you need to know when you're choosing between GIF and SVG. One thing that it doesn't mention is that SVG obviously can't be used for non-vector content, at least not without losing a lot of its benefits. So for example, if you have, you know, your cat GIFs can't really be made into SVGs unless they're custom illustrations.
Custom cat GIFs.
Custom cat GIFs.
The second article by Sarah is talking about different tips for creating and exporting better SVGs for the web. And what I really enjoy about this article, so there, I mean, there's a lot of articles that kind of talk about this, like this is how you kind of set Illustrator up to export decently formatted SVGs. But Sarah, on this hand, goes in depth, and she even mentions like accessibilities. For example, if you have an SVG that has a font and you outline that font, obviously a screen reader is not going to be able to read that. So she mentions if you're using an SVG in place of a headline or something, you should add titles and alt tags and such, just to make sure that the accessibility doesn't suffer there. So this article is really great. It covers lots of things like simplifying paths, avoid merging paths unless you don't need to control over the individual paths, simplifying shapes as much as possible, just lots of really good content in here.
I think my favorite one is fit artboard to drawing. Designers, please, please do this. It's a simple thing, but it's really easy to forget. And I've had to do that in so many Illustrator files.
I just have Command-Shift-Forward-Slash fit entered burned into my brain.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Every day, right?
Yeah, every day. Every time I open up an icon in Illustrator, it's always off the artboard. And I guess by default, I might want to try it, actually. Open up one that is aligned and see if I still type it. I feel like I would, just out of habit. As a developer, I really enjoy reading articles like this, especially articles that throw things in, like point number 7 that talks about use good naming, grouping, and layering conventions, because this translates over to the development side. So if I'm working on a project and there's an illustration that needs to be animated, it matters how the illustration is set up, you know, how it's grouped, how the layers are named and everything. So I've worked on projects where things are great and organized, and I've worked on projects where I've had to pretty much restructure an illustration myself. And, you know, when thoughts put into this ahead of time, it makes my life as a programmer a lot easier. But I also like that there's more thought getting thrown around about SVGs and using SVGs properly, because I've been using them a ton, and I really love SVGs.
Yeah, I use SVGs in basically every project I make now. For all the static stuff that can be SVG anyway, it just has so many benefits, and a lot of those are covered in Sarah's article on SVG versus GIF. But even compared to stuff like icon fonts for accessibility reasons, and just actually, it turns out ease of developer use, like with tools like Grunticon, it can be so simple to have really good SVG support all throughout your app. And it's what's really cool about that for me is that not only is the tooling around SVG amazing, but it's become amazing so fast. Like even a couple of years ago, using SVGs wasn't really feasible because of, first of all, browser support, and secondly, the tooling just wasn't there to make it simple. And now all of a sudden we have just like this complete embarrassment of riches of great SVG tools.
Yeah, that's something we've actually been talking a lot about in our Slack recently too. People have been talking about icon fonts. I guess I linked an article that was talking about how, you know, people should just kind of move to using SVGs instead. And so we've had a few people asking questions like, you know, why would I do that, or what are the benefits? And I can throw a few of the links in the show notes. But you know, accessibility reasons, some browsers just don't even support icon fonts. Like maybe it's an outlier, but Opera Mini just doesn't even do it. You know, that coupled with like tools, like you said, like Grunticon or Gulp Icon Font or anything like that, makes it so easy to not only just use SVGs efficiently in your code, but also automate minifying and cleaning up and, you know, turning them into sprites. And also a lot of these tools provide fallbacks as well. So if you're working on a project that needs support, IE8, they provide fallbacks, to auto fallback to pings or something for you. So you don't even have to worry about it.
Yeah, Grunt specifically will actually output three different versions. It'll give you the SVGs embedded in the CSS file. It'll give you pings embedded in a CSS file. And it'll also give you a CSS file that references external pings. So it gives you pretty much everything and then a little JavaScript snippet that automatically detects what the browser supports best and will then load in the appropriate style sheet. It's super easy for developers and it just gives your users an amazing experience.
Well, not only that, but I believe Grunticon 2 gives you the option of inlining SVGs that you want as well, which makes it perfect for animations and things like that.
Yep. It's not limited just to backgrounds and that sort of stuff anymore. You actually can get them directly injected into the page and then have full control over animation, color, whatever you want to do with it, because it's just a full-on SVG embedded directly into your web page. Makes it super easy to work with. So if you're not using Grunticon right now or the Gulp equivalent, which I believe is called Gulp SVG Icon, but we'll get a link to that in show notes for sure. But if you're not using either of those, definitely check those out because they save a huge amount of time and they will make your sites better and more accessible compared to icon fonts. We've talked about certificatechain.io before, and that makes it really easy to take your SSL certs and get them all in the right order and include all the appropriate signing authorities and everything like that. But there is another new service called letsencrypt.org, and this is really neat. Instead of giving you tools to work with your existing certificates, they will actually give anyone a free SSL cert that is trusted in all major browsers. So if you have either a hobby site or your personal site or anything that you just want to have HTTPS on there to provide a bit more additional security for your users, this is a great way to do that. It's completely free, and I think this is awesome. You know, pretty much the entire internet should be on SSL. There's no reason not to. And now this takes away any monetary constraints as well.
Yeah, it's something that I've been meaning to try out. In fact, I might even just try it out on my own site over the next week and report back on how that goes.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I love stuff like this that makes certificates and security easier and more accessible to everybody.
I don't know why it is, but whenever I've installed a few certs, and whenever I do that, I just feel so accomplished.
Well, I mean, before all these tools existed, it used to be a giant pain, and it still kind of is, depending on your server setup.
Right. I think I mentioned before that I've screwed up a few times and had to purchase multiple certs in the past.
It's easy to do, especially with how outdated a lot of the certificate purchasing websites are.
Yeah, not only that, but I feel like a lot of the documentation on those sites are written from, or, you know, someone that completely understands the process wrote those documentations. So when I read it, I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't get it. So speaking of developer conveniences, I think I might have mentioned it in the last couple episodes or maybe the last episode, but I found a really awesome article by Anna Tudor on Smashing Magazine called Getting Started with CSS Calc. And mainly what I've used Calc for is just kind of layout math. You know, if I'm doing grid type stuff and I don't need a full-fledged grid, I'll just use Calc to do that for me. But this article explains what it does, you know, and then it goes through and gives a pretty good number of examples of how you can use it. And the cool thing is a lot of these examples I would have never have thought to use Calc for, like building complex gradients. There is an example of her building a flag using the linear gradient in Calc. But one of the most useful items I thought was her point about maintaining aspect ratio and covering a viewport dimension. Now, I've worked on a couple of projects where I needed to do this, whether it's like video thumbnails needing to fit into a grid or something like that. And I've always achieve that by using like a padding trick or something, but this calc method makes it seem so much simpler. It just combines calc and the viewport unit, and when I look at these code snippets, it's more apparent to me immediately what's happening, as opposed to if I look at some of my old code snippets using like weird padding tricks.
In conjunction with calc last week, we actually talked about Flexbox as well. And Sean, just a few days ago, you linked me this amazing game. It's called Flexbox Froggy. It's just flexboxfroggy.com. And it breaks down the really complex syntax of Flexbox and makes it super easy to learn. It's in a game format. And so you just type some code on the left and it moves these little frogs onto their lily pads on the right. It's super well done. And it really helps make these concepts stick into your head. I went through the whole thing and it's amazing. I love this thing. I think it's such a great way to teach a somewhat difficult concept to especially people who have already been developing with CSS for a while, where you have all these other weird tips and tricks stuffed in your head, and maybe it's kind of hard to get a new one in there. But this just makes it so, so easy to remember, and it's fun too, honestly.
Yeah, I think the most difficult thing about Flexbox is the terminology, the keywords that you have to use for this thing. I think that's the most confusing part about it. And Flexbox Froggy gets around that by not only, you know, explaining what each property does, but as you type it, it visually shows you, which to me really just kind of made things click in my head.
It's so much more memorable having that visual reinforcement that you're doing this correctly, or maybe even more importantly, you're doing this incorrectly. It makes it very clear to see exactly what each property does.
By moving frogs on top of their lily pads.
They got to get home, man.
So today, I used View Resource on Flaticons on a couple of the components that I was redoing, because instead of just, you know, doing jQuery AJAX requests, I figured it would be a cleaner, and I took out quite a few lines of just kind of repetitive code and then replaced it with View Resource stuff, and it works just perfect. It works great, and it's readable. It's clean. It works. And so before, I was using the concept of a store, right? Having all the data transferring through one file. So you would hit a method, you'd call a method on that store, and that method would be responsible for firing off the data. I moved it back into a couple of the components to see how I felt, and I'm kind of torn. I like the idea of having all of that isolated in one spot, but in practice, actually building the components, it's really convenient just to have it right there.
Sure. And View Resource makes it so, so clean. Like, it's one or two lines for all of your AJAX stuff. It's really easy. It's just the best.
So actually the path for this form, okay, so there's a search thing in the admin and there's a search thing in the dashboard. They're essentially the same thing. One is scoped to icons that you own and one is not. And also they have different form URLs, one /admin, which gives you the unscoped icons, and one is /app/certs. So the path is just a prop that gets passed in from the view. And then I set the root of that resource to that path, and the code is the same on both sides. Apart from that, it works great. Now I've got this application coming up, and part of the onboarding flow is going to have people upload a CSV, just, you know, a CSV file to pull data into the app. And I don't remember who linked it. Maybe you linked it to me. This tool called Pop-Up Parse. But this tool is awesome, and it has saved me a lot of time. And all it does is it parses CSVs for you and turns it into JSON, and it handles like malformed CSVs and errors and such.
So is this a front-end or a back-end tool?
So I think predominantly front-end, but I believe there's a stripped-down version that you can use on the server as well. I think it's Pop-Up Parse Lite or something.
Nice. But you're using it on the front-end.
Yeah, I'm using it on the front end. So the idea was that since it handles, so it gives you intelligent error messages. So if you, as a customer, uploaded a CSV that wasn't formatted correctly, it would say, hey, there's an error on row 100, and this is what the error is. You know, the idea is that we can have, if we needed, a quick iteration process with that customer, essentially, so that way we don't have to post it to the server and have the server check stuff and have it come back, right? And the cool thing about Pop-Up Parse is that it's super fast. In fact, we had the clients come out for a meeting, just to talk through some things. And I figured I would put together a little demo of this for them. And so in a JS Fiddle, I pulled everything together and pulled it into view and demonstrated how fast this thing is. And so I can't remember what set it was, but I generated CSV files with 5,000 records, 10,000 records, 25,000 records, 50,000 records, 100,000 records, and 150,000 records. And I believe the 150,000 records was parsed in under 15 seconds. Like, it was fast. Yeah, so the idea is, you know, when you as the customer upload a CSV file, it gets parsed, and then underneath that, we show you a representation of what the data looks like. So we're looking for specific fields, and so we'll have a table that shows up underneath with, here's what we thought are some first names, here what we thought are some last names, and here's what we thought is an email address. Does this look correct? And that way, if you think the customer gets instant feedback, right? And since this thing is so fast, I doubt anyone's going to have 150,000 customers, right? Not that it would matter because it's so fast, but they get an instant feedback. Hey, this is what we think your data looks like. Is this correct? Yes. Cool. Let's keep it moving. So this is, I guess, Papa Parse is a great example of a tool that saved me a lot of time, and it worked really well.
It sounds like it saved you a lot of time, but it also is going to save users a lot of time. Because instead of having to fill a form out, submit it, get an error back, try to find the error, fix it, they get live results in live preview, which is pretty awesome, or at least very close to live.
Right. And we had kicked around the idea of having, you know how MailChimp does a thing where you can map, you give them data and you map columns to your data.
Sure.
So we talked about that, and I looked at it, and it was really confusing. Like, I knew what this thing did, and I was still having a tough time figuring the UI or feeling really confident what I was doing with that UI. Then I understand why they have to do that, because they don't have a defined set of data that they need from you. You can basically define what you give them, right? But in our case, we have a defined set of data that we're looking for. So, you know, we ended up deciding not to do that, because since we know what we're looking for, we can put a little bit more time into catching errors, or, you know, looking at the formatting and make sure we're getting it correct versus having the user do some of that work.
That's pretty nice. And I really like that idea of making sure that the implementation matches the use case and not just saying, well, MailChimp does it this way, I should do it that way too, because MailChimp has been successful. I think that's a pretty common attitude where it's like, this thing has worked for someone else. And so even if my use case is different, I have to do it the same way because it worked for them. So I think that's a pretty healthy approach you're taking there.
Yeah, I mean, it just comes out better in the end. It's going to be simpler. You know, I think that the simpler we can make this process of onboarding people, you know, obviously the better conversion rates there will be. And so I was all for, like, yeah, let's not do that. And once everyone kind of signed off, I was so stoked because, you know, the simplicity won out.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, Lucky Number 13. Also, our thanks to Hired for sponsoring Does Not Compute. If you still haven't signed up for Hired, now is the time. They've got so many great jobs available from some of the best companies around. And if you sign up using our link, hired.com/doesnotcompute, they'll give you a $4,000 bonus when you get a new job through them. It's completely free to use, and there are zero obligations, so make sure you check them out. If you haven't done it yet, leaving an iTunes rating or review would mean a lot to both Sean and myself. It just takes a minute, and it's a great way to help spread the word if you enjoy the show.